This is Captain Rob Woodard, tape two.
Yes, the jungle, flying over it and working in it was an extraordinary thing from a naval aviator's point of view, where you'd spent your life, pretended to, at sea and flying over the sea to a beach or 2 or 3 miles inland to land troops in some form of assault or as a landing prior to a build-up. So there one was based ashore, flying over the jungle. The jungle is romantic. At times, I found it a terrifying place to be in. I went out on patrol with some Gurkhas to see how one should get on and what they were actually up to. I mean, it was both interest and an element of survival. And I mean, the first thing is I couldn't bear the Gurkhas foo-hooed. And all Gurkha officers became heroes to me after that, because they go off as with their troops with a pound of rice last week. And that didn't appeal to me at all. It was a very good discipline. But they disappeared into the jungle, and one was left on a tiny path. They made no noise as they chopped their way through solid stuff either side of you. And I thought they had left me and vanished. And I started to make sort of cooey noises because it was all rather lonely. And they appeared and said, "For God's sake, be quiet, you know, you'll attract the enemy." And they'd been nearby. And the jungle's full of noise, it isn't silent. If it is silent, then it normally means something unpleasant's happening or about to, because the animals have all shut up and disappeared. Or they make an enormous amount of noise indicating presence. Seem to be one or the other. It's never very quiet. But flying over the jungle at dusk with amazing sunsets, at dawn with equally amazing sort of new days with the mist just starting to form in the trees. Very picturesque, and one could wax quite lyrical about it. And sort of edge of the far pavilions. But you always were terribly aware of the sort of menace. Because one minute it was absolutely lovely and all was going well, and you were on time, and you knew that you were going in the right direction, and it was beautiful and interesting. And the next minute you could be in total silence after a blood-curdling explosion, and the thing was rushing down into the trees. And you needed to keep reminding yourself of that, because the only way you were going to survive was by being awfully well aware of what you were up to. So you lived in a sort of schizophrenic existence. And then having flown out, having spent a few weeks operating in the jungle or a week walking around on a patrol, you've flown back and might find yourself in the wardroom of your carrier supping a gin, delighted at the air conditioning starting to heal your ulcering mosquito bites and the leech holes and things. Shooting the most appalling lines to nice supply officers and things who didn't get the chance to come and have that sort of interest. Something that happened whilst I was out there, so it'd be in 1960, was one of our
Go on.
as soon as the Malayan emergency ended in June 1960, we started doing exercises in Borneo and Sarawak. And an interesting one to me was when we went across in Bulwark to Borneo and had a 2 week exercise with the Royal Marines, our chums in 4-2 Commando. Who by now were getting fairly used to flying around in helicopters, or very used to getting flying around in helicopters, and quite grumpy if we weren't at the right place at the right time, quite naturally. And now starting, having done the 2 week exercise with them, we then went back to Singapore and picked up a battalion of Gurkhas. I think it was the 2nd, but it might have been the 2nd, 6th. And we flew to, sorry, we took them back to Borneo. And put them into exactly the same exercise. So for the squadron air crew, it was the same exercise entirely, but with different troops. And both commandos and the Gurkhas, it was the first time they'd done it. And it was very interesting to see the difference. We had become very good friends with the Gurkhas during the Malayan time, and so it was a delight to be working with them again. And because they had only been given helicopters when they were available before, and now they were actually acting as a sort of helicopter mobile force, they were very pleased. And they rushed into the aircraft and out of it and did their drills very beautifully. And it was fun for us to see the sort of the sparkle of enthusiasm about our work, because to the Royal Marines, quite rightly, we had tended to become rather the taxi driver. Later on, after that, and before I left the commando business out there and flew home, went to Blackamatty for a great annual day that they have when sheep are beheaded and things. During the exercise in Borneo and operating with the Gurkhas in Borneo, there were many occasions when one was unable to pick up the whole of a patrol, usually for weight reasons. And so you'd have to leave half or a third behind and hope that you could get back while the weather still held or before it was dark. And one was always felt rather guilty at doing that, although there was absolutely nothing one could do about it. And I knew that they thoroughly enjoyed sweet things. So I used to carry bags of barley sugars from the naffy on board. And if I had to leave anyone behind, I'd throw them down some barley sugars in way of apology. And I didn't really think very much about that until some months later, when back in Singapore, we went to a great gathering at Blackamatty, which is the headquarters of the Gurkhas. Several of us were invited for the Dussehra festival. And after a very good curry lunch with ample amounts of beer and things, we went to watch a very important hockey match, because I'm sure you know the Gurkhas are mad keen on their hockey. And we were standing as a team of officers on one side with the Gurkha officers, and on the other side of the pitch, cheering equally loudly, were the men. And at half time, one of them said something in a loud voice, which I, in Gurkhali, I didn't know what it was. And they all came steaming across the pitch and carried me round the football pitch, shoulder high, shouting this word, which when I was put down, I said, what on earth was all that about? And they said, the barley sugar man. And it had obviously had much more of an effect on them than it did on me, but it was very gratifying to think that they had enjoyed their barley sugars. By the time confrontation started, I had transferred to the Buccaneer aircraft, which is a strike bomber, and was out in the Far East again, now in the aircraft carrier Eagle with the Mark I Buccaneer in 800 Squadron. We had targets given to the crews. Each crew had its allocated targets, primary and secondary target. Every day you went down to the secret room in the bowels of the ship to get out all the documents about your target and see if the intelligence chaps had updated them. My prime target was the Irion, the Sverdlov cruiser, which was alongside in harbour in Indonesia and liable to stay there for some time. But one was obviously keen to see if steam had been got up or whether there were more movements around her that she might move, because we'd need to track her. And the other target was the Surabaya oil storage tanks, which were well north of that. And the orders were that when you did your ordinary day sortie from sea in the South China Sea, we were staying in that sort of area. And bearing in mind that these machines cruised at 500 miles an hour or more, so you could actually cover a fair amount of ground in an hour's sortie. That once a day, or at least three times a week, for example, one would go to an area that you had actually found on the map, which was exactly similar to your target, and do a proper run-in. and the Surabaya run, I remember my observer and I found an identical place near Kuantan on the east coast. And we'd do a landfall over that, running in the attack profile, which one lofted one's bombs from 4.5 miles in a steep pool. So you needed very accurate navigation to get exactly over the point where you would press the accept button to allow the automatic sequence to take place. And one got to the stage where one can see now why people get very frustrated when they're stopped in the middle of an epic, because one had practiced dropping the bombs on the Surabaya oil fields so often, you really rather wanted to do it. I certainly wanted to have a go at the Sverdlov cruiser, because their navy was making life very unpleasant for other elements of our navy. And then we would spend time off Borneo, when our sea vixens would give high cover for operations going on the ground. And indeed the buccaneers were called in on occasions. We were able to carry 8 1,000-pound bombs. We could carry 2-inch rockets and various other things. But as far as I can recall, the only thing that we did do in anger was to drop sonic booms. If you go into a gentle dive, you can get a very accurate sonic boom. The Buccaneer isn't supersonic straight and level, but at 0.9 mark in a dive, it creates a supersonic bang. And that puts... Confrontation with Indonesia was my first introduction to the complications of political warfare. We were there with considerable weight, 2 strike carriers and the whole of the Far East fleet, a lot of military men on the ground in Borneo, back in Singapore and around and about. And it was a confrontation. It's not a war. It had pockets of considerable activity. And, I mean, one's read and knew then about the sort of things going on with the Special Air Service, the Marines, the Gurkhas, all involved, policing borders, mainly trying to stop insurgents coming through to create difficulties. So it wasn't appropriate that we should come in and obliterate a capital or explode the major oil source. So one was just ready for whatever might be required, and it was very frustrating. You can train as with an athlete to a stage where you've overtrained, and it was a delicate balance. Whereas we knew that our own people were flying sometimes great hazard inside the jungle, policing and helping and lifting out wounded people, etc., we were unable to do anything that we felt was really helping them. But of course, our help was the fact we were there. It was a major deterrent which stopped Indonesia doing anything else, because in front of their very eyes they could see the might of what would crack them over the skull if they did anything incautious. I'm not aware that during confrontation, as far as the Borneo end was concerned, that we actually fired any or dropped any weaponry from the fixed-wing aircraft from the carriers. What we did do on certainly one occasion was to deliver a sonic boom. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that actually where you've all heard Concorde going overhead and people worry about the cathedral glass and things, you can actually direct one of those booms with great accuracy, and it will do a lot of damage. I mean, it'll demolish a greenhouse that you've aimed at. The Buccaneer isn't supersonic, and you have to go supersonic in straight and level flight. You have to go supersonic to create a bang. So you went into a shallowish dive at full throttle, aimed your gun sight at what you really wanted to give the best benefit of your boom to. And as you went through Mark 1, out went the boom of the sound barrier, And it would flatten the greenhouse. So you can imagine that if you were in the jungle and you heard this, you would imagine that someone was bombing you. And it was only after a time that they realized that since there was no smoke and no burning debris and no villages had been blown away, that there must be something else creating the bang. But it was very effective as it was required. What was fired in anger, and is a story which I have only second hand, was when a patrol that had been ambushed and had several wounded in it needed to be picked out in a great hurry. The only clearing nearby was overlooked by a rocky outcrop, and it was a hazard to take a helicopter in there because since the patrol had been ambushed, it meant that Indonesians were in the area. And if they cared to get up onto the rocky outcrop, they would have no difficulty whatsoever in finishing off the helicopter once it had landed or while it was trying to land. They would have the advantage. So it was decided to send three helicopters, two equipped with forward-firing machine guns, and one of them also with the SS-11 wire-guided anti-tank missile, and one to pick the team out. And so to soften up anyone who might possibly be on the rock, the two gunship helicopters went in and splattered bullets at it, and one of them fired a live SS-11 into the base of the cliff, which gave off a lovely bang and clouds of smoke. And in the confusion left by that, the passenger-carrying helicopter zipped in and picked out the patrol. In fact, I think it may have been two, doesn't matter. They picked out the patrol. And later, when they went in again with a new team to go and find the Indonesians who had ambushed the people and do work, they discovered at the bottom of the cliff a cave with a heavy machine gun in it and its team of Indonesians who had taken the full force of the SS-11, which had just been fired haphazardly. So that was a very lucky shot. And as I'm aware, the only SS-11 fired in anger during that time. Confrontation, as far as the fixed-wing element of the force was concerned, and I then was flying the Buccaneers in 800 Squadron in Eagle, was really a frustrating business. One was working very hard to maintain the right operational standards and to ensure that our target dossiers were up to date. We couldn't really go away and have exciting visits to places which one enjoys in the Far East, because in effect there was a war trying to break out, and one was a deterrent and a containment force. When one disembarked to places like Changi on Singapore Island, which was the Buccaneer shore base there, when the carrier went into harbour, you actually turned the circuit only about a mile outside Indonesian airspace. And so everybody was very jittery. So whilst we were doing our patrols and flying around, trying to be helpful and being ready, but sleeping in a comfortable bed at night and having the occasional ice-cold drink on the quarterdeck, there were some people who were absolutely up to their neck in unpleasantness. And I refer to our naval helicopters who were right in the jungle at Nanga Ghat and such places, with some very challenging flying, and they suffered quite a number of fatalities and came in direct confrontation on several occasions. And then nearer the coast, the Royal Air Force in support. And there the people who, from the air side, the men in the jungle flying the helicopters, who were the air heroes of the confrontation. Situations such as the confrontation bring out not only the best in most military men, but they also tend to highlight various characters who are remembered through history for incidents that went on during that time. And having flown helicopters before, there were three men who I knew well, who became very much the men of the moment in the jungle. They all carried out extremely daring journeys, either for rescues or insertions, in night operations, which really weren't a thing that one would normally plan specifically. Those three men being Digby Lickfold, who was commanding a squadron out there, and who sadly died a few weeks ago. Commander Geoffrey Sherman, who's always known as Tank, and he carried out one or two very interesting operations. And Peter Williams. They all flew for several years in the jungle, from Nanga Ghat and such places. And those are the three, and I think the only three naval aviators, who were privileged to be given the Order of the Yellow Elephant or something like that. You'd have to ask them exactly what it's called. It's rather a smart neck decoration, which they wear with great pride to this day. Those three men were all awarded with a very important decoration, I believe, by the Sultan of Brunei personally for their actions during the confrontation. And I think it's called the Order of the Yellow Elephant. It's a very smart thing that hangs around your neck, and they're dutifully proud.